Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Mission Nemesis by Anthony James. Narrated by Neil Heligers. War Games. The defenders were holed up deep in a cave and showed no sign they were willing to surrender. Without heavy weapons, the attackers were limited to firing their Gauss rifles blindly into the opening. It was enough to keep the defenders pinned down, and they made no effort to launch what would be a suicidal counterattack. Lieutenant Leo Jones watched from the cover of loose scattered boulders, less than 200 meters from the cave's entrance. The tactical readout from his spacesuit helmet served up non-stop updates for him to consider. The most important limitation for the moment was time. The defenders only needed to hang on for another 15 minutes before their battleship emerged from lightspeed, at which point it would be game over for Jones and his squad. The men and women he commanded were in a ragged semicircle, using whatever scant cover was available to them. Every so often, one would fire a Gauss rifle, more in hope than any realistic expectation. Jones scanned the battlefield. The ground was level here, made from smooth yellow stone, with a peculiarly reflective sheen from the presence of some type of mineral, the type of which he neither knew nor cared to learn. The cave mouth was 3 or 4 meters wide and high, one of several at the base of a 500-meter almost sheer escarpment. The cliff face jutted from the ground like the teeth of a long-forgotten god. Overhead, the skies were clear and dark. A trick of the atmosphere caused the stars to magnify when viewed from the surface, and they liberally sprinkled the blackness, yet without providing anything like enough illumination to see clearly. Zelen's sun was shining on the far side of the planet, leaving the combatants to face each other in temperatures well below zero. Jones didn't know how or why the battlefield computer had chosen this location. There were hundreds of similar war games being played out across the surface of the planet. The stats guys probably liked a good cross-section of different arenas, he thought. "These games do not interest me," said Raz Val through a private channel. "When there is nothing at stake, it is hard to commit fully." The guest's interpreted voice had a rasping edge to it, which the spacesuit language module did its best to smooth off and convert into something human-sounding. Jones agreed with Rosvall's assessment, to a degree. Sometimes it took a real discharge of your weapon in order for these exercises to feel as if they had significance. All they were doing here was firing laser-projecting dummy weapons and waiting for the battlefield computer to say who had been killed. Those who died early had to play dead for a mind-numbing 2 hours until the scenario was completed. "Our troops will see the benefits," Jones said. "Our two sides must think as friends if we are to be effective against the Estral threat."
"Estral, ta! We haven't seen them for nearly 2 years. They have given up on us."
Jones thought the words strangely dismissive, since the Ghasts and Estral were mortal enemies. They'd split 400 years previously, but the hatred still ran deeply. "You may be right. Fear of their return has kept our two species working in harmony since the end of the Great War between us. An unrealized threat can have unforeseen benefits."
"We Ghasts do not underestimate the threat, but there must be a point at which we accept their arrival is no longer imminent."
Jones looked out from behind his rock with his Gauss rifle pressed to his shoulder. The movement and heat sensors from his suit picked up nothing. The opposition squad were content to wait it out, and he couldn't blame them. He ducked away again, admitting to himself that his heart wasn't in it. The enemy squad had rigged up a shielded portable sensor array somewhere on the rock face above the cave mouth. It gave them warning when any troops ran forwards, and they were able to pick off the assault by staying 100 meters inside. There were 9 or 10 mock casualties lying motionless in the shadow of the entrance, doubtless wishing they were anywhere except this cold, unwelcoming planet. Jones took a deep breath in order to bring his mind onto the task in hand. He knew some of the rookies, and even a few of the vets treated these exercises seriously. The victors always took the opportunity to load it up in at the barrack rooms later. Jones owed it to the men and women to give it his best shot. "Listen up. The rebels have an Ultor due in orbit," he said across the open channel. "Latest intel suggests we have less than 15 minutes before it arrives. While we stand here, we'll be an easy target for an orbital missile strike. Our only hope is to get inside that tunnel and kill those bastards. We'll be safe from the enemy battleship until then. Reports suggest the rebels have a broadcasting unit we can use to call in reinforcements. They won't want to risk their lone Ultor against a Confederation fleet."
"Sir, they're too well dug in," said Corporal Peterson. "As soon as we get inside, they'll pick us off with their rifles as we advance."
"There is rarely a solution that will allow a confrontation to end without casualties," said Rosvold.
He was in the group with Jones, Peterson, and a few others. The Ghast towered over all of the humans. He wasn't wearing a mech suit, preferring an adapted version of the human spacesuits. Even so, the alien was taller and broader than every one of the humans, a giant amongst children. He had one of the Ghast rifles in his hands. It was heavier, slower, and packed less of a punch than the human equivalent. In this, at least, the Ghast's technology hadn't overtaken that possessed by the Confederation.
"We cannot lose this one,"
growled Rish Leo, one of the three Ghasts amongst a dozen humans. The language modules couldn't yet produce an accurate translation of the alien names. There wasn't always an exact word in the Confederation tongue. The best guess for Rish Leo was Havoc, and Jones had come across this name applied to different-sounding Ghast names. There'd be teams of language specialists in the Space Corps, fascinated by the subtleties, but it wasn't something Jones spent time thinking about. "Team 1 and Team 2, make a run for the cliff wall. Take up positions to the left and right," said Jones. "Team 3, you're coming with me. We'll head straight down the center while 1 and 2 give us cover." Team 3 was the largest of the three teams and was going to suffer the majority of the casualties. Raz Vol's words had reminded Jones of the truth about these encounters. They were hazardous and dirty for both sides. "There's no such thing as a war without death," he said to himself. The first two teams broke away from cover, keeping to a specific pattern that ensured nobody stood in a direct line behind someone else. The Gauss projectiles didn't care how many bodies were in the way. They'd travel through three or four soldiers if they were aimed right, and still have enough energy to travel another few hundred meters out the other side. The battlefield computer could simulate multiple kills from a single shot, so it paid to stay alert.
"Team 1 in position," said Corporal Peterson.
Moments later, Rish Leo and his team arrived on the opposite side of the cave.
"Team 2 ready," he said. "No shot so far."
"Keep them pinned down," said Jones. Teams 1 and 2 enacted a well-oiled routine. Two members of the team crouched at the side walls and aimed into the depths of the cave. The others lay flat on the ground to minimize their profile while they fired inside.
"I'm picking up return fire," said Corporal Peterson. "They're more than 100 meters back. Looks as if there's a branch in the passage to the left, and they're in there. There's almost nowhere to hide until we reach them, sir."
"I'm detecting movement from 6 or 7 enemy soldiers," said Rish Leo. "There are fewer than we thought."
"Don't let up," said Jones. He broke cover, feeling the weight of his spacesuit drag against him as he sprinted forward. His footsteps crunched over the thin film of coarse dust on the rock, throwing up grit in his wake. Behind, Raz Vol and another 9 humans followed. Jones had command of this assault, though Raz Vol technically outranked him. The Ghast had voiced no concern that he'd been given a subordinate position. The aliens rarely complained about anything. It took 30 seconds to reach the cave entrance, and Jones was breathing hard when he got there. He jumped over the body of a fallen soldier and dashed inside. There was hardly any ambient light, even less than there was outside. His helmet sensor fought to correct its feed, and distant outlines became hazy-edged greens from the image intensifiers. The spacesuits used by the Space Corps were well insulated and emitted little discernible heat. However, the movement of the occupants was as easy to detect as ever. The spacesuit identified 3 or 4 sources of activity ahead and overlaid them with a clear orange. Jones fired instinctually. He was a good shot, but had no way of knowing if he'd hit anything.
"I'm down," said Quinn.
She was in Jones's team, and there was more resignation in her voice than anything else. The walls of the cave were near smooth and offered no shelter, like Corporal Peterson had warned. Orange shapes of movement flashed in and out of sight ahead and to the left, closer with each long stride along the passage. Jones kept his shoulder to the wall, hoping he'd present less of a target and knew the others would be doing the same.
"They got me," said Clements.
"I'm hit,"
screamed Smith, hemming up the pain of her simulated injury.
"Watch your aim,"
shouted Corporal Peterson. His voice climbed an octave with the stress, and Jones guessed Team 3 had suffered a friendly fire kill. These exercises were hardest of all on the low-ranking officers, since they invariably felt as if they were being judged on the outcome. In this, they were correct. Now they'd realized an all-out assault was underway, the enemy squad was forced into taking greater risks. The movement sensors picked up more activity, and the orange highlights became larger and larger. Jones shot a couple of times and was pretty sure he scored at least one hit. When he reached the passage, he dropped to a crouch, tight to the wall, and fired a burst of projectiles. Someone ran past him. It was Rish Leo. The Ghast had broken away from his assigned position in order to take part in the final execution of the enemy squad. He'd need to be reprimanded for it. Moments later, it was over. The opposition lay dead in a cluster at the entrance to a branching passage from the main one. They'd lost others before reaching the cave, evidently more than Jones had realized, leaving them with hardly anyone to defend against this attack. Even without heavy weapons or grenades, this had been a bad result for both sides, and seven of Jones's squad were also dead, including Rish Leo, who'd been taken out by a burst of Gauss fire. "Scenario complete," flashed across Jones's HUD. "Squad A, Lieutenant Leo Jones, are victorious."
"Well fought," said Jones, speaking to his own squad and the vanquished enemy. "You can get up now."
There were many expressions of relief at these words. The dead enemy soldiers who'd holed up in this cave rolled to their feet, and one or two patted themselves down. There were no Ghasts amongst them. The alien members of Squad B had been killed much earlier in the scenario in a typically bravado-ridden attempt to achieve an improbable victory at the wrong time. One of the men made his way to stand before Jones.
"Sir?"
It was Corporal Wire, the last of Squad B to fall.
"What is it, Corporal?"
"While we were scouting this cave looking for a way out, we found something."
"What sort of something?" asked Jones. He was already interested, since there was otherwise nothing of note on Zillin that he was aware of.
"It's metal, sir. There's a pile of rubble, and one of the guys saw something in the middle of it. We didn't have a chance to take a proper look."
"Show me where it is," said Jones. Corporal Wire bobbed his head in acknowledgement and set off along the side passage. Jones followed, and Raz Vol came behind. The Ghasts weren't excessively curious, so there must have been something about this sighting which had got Razvol's attention. The passage was high and wide and drifted slightly downwards. Jones wasn't an expert, but something about the regularity of the walls and floor made him think the place was more than a natural fault in the rock. The passage continued for a couple of hundred meters before offering a right-hand turn. This new branch looked far more natural. It was a vertical crack in the otherwise featureless surface. The original passage continued onwards, with no sign of ending.
"The main route goes on and on," said Corporal Wire. "We never did find out where it goes to. This side passage was a whole lot easier to explore."
"Lead on," said Jones, waving the corporal through. The side passage was a tight squeeze at first, particularly for Roz Vol. The Ghast had to punch hard to get through the opening, and his suit helmet scraped alarmingly across the wall. After a few meters, it opened out, becoming a wide space.
"We thought it was a natural cave or something, sir," said Corporal Wire. "It's pretty big."
Jones looked around and saw Roz Vol do the same. His helmet sensor sent pings around the cavern and provided an approximate size of the place. It was a few hundred meters across, over 100 meters high, and roughly circular in shape. There were rocks of varying sizes, most of them piled in the middle of the floor.
"You might not be able to see it from here, but there's a big hole in the roof, which looks like it caved in at some point and brought all this stone down with it. The funny thing is, when you look at it from closer up, the hole looks like a perfect circle."
The three of them walked across the cavern floor. It took a few moments before Jones noticed something was wrong.
"No comms in here?" he asked. "No, sir. Must be something in the walls blocking them. The effect isn't so bad back the way we came."
The pile of rubble was enormous, dozens of meters high and a couple of hundred across. Once or twice, Jones heard the click-clack noise of smaller stones tumbling away down the sides.
"Unstable," grunted Raz Vol.
"There's a gap between these two boulders," said Corporal Wire.
The man raised an arm and pointed at an area of blackness between two huge, unevenly shaped rocks.
"It's not the sort of place I'd willingly stick my own head without being asked, but Padilla's the man who went in. He says he's one of mankind's natural explorers."
"What's in there?" asked Jones.
"It's an angular piece of smooth metal, sir. It's nearly black, and I'm certain there's a lot more of it than I've been able to see."
"Black?"
asked Roz Vol.
"Yes, sir," said Wire. "I have no idea what it is."
Roz Vol pushed his way past Corporal Wire and entered the gap. There was plenty of room, and Jones watched the Ghast's outline vanish from view.
"Damn it," he muttered, and then followed.
By the time Jones entered the gap, Roz Vol was out of sight. The noise of the Ghast clambering over stones was clearly audible ahead, and there was only one route he could have taken. Jones worked his way 15 or 20 meters into the rock pile. He imagined the weight of the rocks above, and did his best to ignore the thought of them crashing down. He found Roz Vol. The Ghast had stopped in a tight space amongst the rocks. There was room for Jones to come alongside, and he did so. He picked up something in the Ghast's demeanor, clearly noticeable even with the anonymity of the spacesuit. It could have been shock or uncertainty. Perhaps fear. The Ghast reached out a hand and rubbed his palm over the smooth surface of something alien to this planet. Realizing he'd been relying on the image intensifiers up till now, Jones switched on the helmet light. The illumination was stark and harsh in the confines of the space, and it highlighted the flat side of something metal. At least, he assumed it was metal, since it was darker in shade than any other metal he could recall seeing, whatever it was.
It was impossible to tell how large it was. Here and there he could see flashes of its surface through the rocks above, and it vanished below, seemingly into the ground itself.
"What is it?" he asked Rosvold, sensing the Ghast had seen similar before.
Rosvold didn't answer at once. When he did, it was with the barely inflected words of his suit's language modules.
"I don't know."
The longer the human Ghast alliance persisted, the better the language modules became at translating nuances in the alien speech. There was something in Rosvold's words which caused Jones to hesitate.
"Estral?" he asked. "I don't know," Rosvold repeated.
"I'll have to tell my superiors what we found." The Ghast stiffened at the words, and Jones was taken aback at the reaction. It was as if Rosvold wished for this object to remain unfound. It wasn't the time or place to press for answers, so Jones worked his way back through the rocks and rejoined the others. It was a full 5 minutes before the Ghast followed. 1. The Tilsar military base on planet Overtide was the third largest in the Confederation. Decades previously, expansion into the Garen sector had been aggressive and actively encouraged by the Council. At the time, this sector was viewed as humanity's new frontier, to be populated and its resources exploited. As a consequence, the Space Corps had invested heavily in new facilities, only to subsequently find there were no other habitable planets within acceptable light-speed range. Atlantis was the last to be found, and after that there was nothing within months of high-speed travel. Thus, the eyes of the Confederation turned elsewhere in search of expansion. The Overtide facilities remained, but their expansion was brought to a halt, upon which moment their gradual, inevitable decline began. That is, until the discovery of the Estral threat. Not long after this hostile species began concerted efforts to invade through the Helios Black Star wormhole, the money began pouring once more into the Tilsar facility. The base and its adjacent shipyard were now home to 250,000 workers, not including the many hundreds of thousands more who operated and worked in the resulting supply chain. The activity hardly slowed, whichever hour of the day one cared to check. When Overtide's long evening came, a vast series of lights embedded in the ground, the walls of the buildings, and mounted on high poles, took the place of the sun and ensured the transition to night had no effect on the base's activities, which continued unabated. There was a metal-walled underground bunker on the base. This wasn't a bunker in the traditional sense, to be used as a refuge for those lucky enough to be permitted inside. This bunker was huge. It was 4,000 meters long, 1,500 wide, and 1,000 deep. Reinforced roof doors, of a similar size to the bunker itself, could be made to slide lengthwise to open or close access from above. There were rooms and corridors, but most of the bunker was no more than a hole in the ground, wherein the Space Corps could work on its larger, more secretive projects without laboring under constant scrutiny. Captain John Nathan Duggan was in one of the rooms, situated high up on one of the longer two walls. It afforded an excellent view onto the floor below, as it had been intended to. Duggan stared downwards, his expression unreadable. He visited this room on most days to watch the progress of the technicians below. Bit by bit, they dismantled the Estral cruiser Balpion, taking it away in pieces, like a flock of carrion birds on the body of a near-dead beast. The sight depressed him. Almost 2 years had passed since he and his crew brought the warship home, and less than half of the original remained. Landing skids, engines clad in dense positron shields, and layers of peeled-back armor. Today, there was something different. No longer was material being taken away from the Valpian. Now, the pieces were being returned. Gravity engine crawlers lugged cubes of galenium inwards instead of outwards, and here and there, components of the warship's missile clusters were visible as they were carried slowly across the gray floor. Cranes were assembled and moved into position, and teams of technicians gathered with their tablets and their diagnostic equipment. There was nothing easy-going about the activity. In fact, Duggan got the impression an army of ants had been flogged with tiny whips until they practically flew to fulfill their designated duties. Duggan stayed for much longer than usual. Finally, he accepted he'd get no answer standing around, so he left the room to begin the long walk to his office. 5 minutes' fast stroll carried him to a lift which ferried him to the surface. He emerged, blinking into the morning light, with several hundred meters of open space to the closest building, and then a further kilometer to his office. He almost caved into the urge to take a car. Something was up, and he dearly wanted to learn what it was. Since his victorious return through the Helios Black Star, his job had become rather quiet. For Duggan, a man of contradictions, this was difficult to cope with.
He craved action, whilst at the same time he was aware he couldn't continue fighting forever.
"Time to grow up, John,"
Lucy McGlashan had once told him, only half-jokingly. Overtide had a temperate climate, more biased to warmth than cold. The day was cloudy, yet the sun's rays were still able to reach the surface, where they unsuccessfully strove to make the drab grays of the military base look cheery instead of bleakly depressing. Vehicles scooted everywhere, with seemingly more purpose than usual, and Duggan watched them pass by, as if he could divine the meaning behind their activities simply by looking. Sheer flat walls loomed overhead as he walked alongside the main research building. Rows of cars were parked in front, and there was a constant flow of people into and out of the main doors. Duggan's office was located in the central administrative building, which was an edifice designed with the apparent purpose of inflicting mental torture on any architect who happened to gaze upon its surfaces. It was 10 stories high, a block made from an ugly mix of concrete, alloys, and glass. Steps led up to the wide doors, flanked by Space Corps and Confederation flags, which fluttered limply in the breeze. People passed by, some of them offering greeting, others doing their best to look elsewhere. Duggan's mouth responded automatically where necessary, while his brain churned over what he'd seen in the bunker. He couldn't deny his consternation at being unaware of the purpose behind this activity. Deep within his chest, a tiny seed of hope took hold, no matter how hard he pretended it wasn't there. Before he knew it, he was in his office. He looked around. It was a good one. One of the best on the facility. It took a good 3 seconds to walk from the door to his desk, and 4 seconds to walk from one wood-paneled side wall to the other. There was carpet on the floor, plants arranged artistically on shelves, and a filigreed chandelier, of a type not seen in the residence of anyone who paid lip service to good taste, dangled from the ceiling. 3 windows ensured light streamed in during the morning. Duggan sat down inside, causing his leather chair to creak in sympathy. His desk was equipped with a wraparound 4-screen console to ensure his eyes were never far from a source of information, even when he might want it otherwise. To add insult to injury, the console was equipped with movement and facial recognition hardware. As soon as Duggan sat down, the displays lit up. The screen to the center left showed a list of Grade 1 minor clearance messages. He'd emptied this mailbox before walking to the bunker, and now there were 79 new ones for him to read. Not for the first time, he asked himself how the admirals of the Space Corps found time to perform any duties beyond the interminable open-read-delete of their emails. Before his outstretched finger could choose from the variety of Grade 1 messages, the far-right screen on his console decided it was time to load the Grade 2 top-clearance messages awaiting Duggan's perusal. There were 312, the top one of which bore the title, Captain Derek's Retirement Party. Shh! Duggan's patience snapped abruptly, and he stood in a burst of movement, almost knocking his chair onto the floor. No sooner had he taken a single step towards the door than he caught sight of a new message. It appeared at the top of the Grade 1 list, in text of alluring red, and prefaced with a high-tier notification of importance. He sat again and opened the message. There wasn't much to it. Fleet Admiral Terran was concise when it suited him. Duggan ran his fingers through his short-cropped hair, and the hint of a smile came to his lips. He shook his head and deleted the message. Moments later, he left his office. The wood-clad metal door slid silently closed behind him like the final ceiling of a coffin he'd escaped. The corridors of the building were identical to each other, but he'd worked here for long enough that he no longer checked the signs for directions. The reception floor was tiled in reflective polished marble, and the soles of his shoes clacked sharply over the surface, setting a rhythm which was audible over the hubbub of the other personnel. He exited through the door by which he had so recently entered. There was a line of neatly parked Space Corps transport cars in front of the administrative building, and he strode to the closest. The last occupant had left the windows open, and there was an empty paper cup in the front passenger seat. Duggan climbed in and was greeted by the smells of hot cloth and stale food. "Landing pad 3," he said.
"Certainly, Captain Duggan,"
responded the car's autopilot in its smooth, androgynous tones. The vehicle pulled away smoothly onto the gray road, maintaining a pre-programmed distance from people and other road traffic.
"Are you having a nice day, Captain Duggan?"
It took a certain personality to be rude to someone who was being nice, even when it was a computer. Duggan was too preoccupied to respond to mindless prattle, so instead he pressed the mute button on the cockpit dashboard, and the voice spoke no more. Landing pad 3 was to the far west of the base. When the car emerged from the space between the final two buildings, it picked up speed, its engine whisking it silently over the flat, open ground adjacent to one of the docking trenches. There was a new Imposition-class cruiser there, undergoing what looked like routine maintenance. Duggan caught the low thrum of its gravity drive, the sound letting him know the vessel was powered up and ready to leave within seconds. He ached to be on board. As he came closer to his destination, Duggan saw distant mountains through the haze, with trees covering the lower foothills. The Tilser base was on flat ground, but the surrounding area was rugged, if not quite harsh. The only roads in and out were to the south, and these wide highways were cut with military precision through endless tons of rock. Space Corps bases were generally welcomed for the money they brought, as long as they were kept away from densely populated areas. Accidents were almost unheard of, this fact being insufficient to deflect concerns about harmful emissions or possible catastrophic explosions. The promised shuttle was waiting for him. It was a sleek design, 30 meters long with a silvery exterior and a low-slung wedge shape, which took more than a few cues from that of a fleet warship. There was a reflective screen over the cockpit, which Duggan was sure served no practical purpose. 8 retractable landing legs supported the craft. Its port-side docking iris was open, and a flight of ingeniously telescopic steps rested on the raised ground of the landing pad. There was a short, gentle slope to the top of the landing pad, and the car stopped at the bottom, where it remained in sullen silence for Duggan to get out. He didn't wait around and walked quickly until he was atop the landing pad, which was raised a few meters above the surrounding area of the airfield. 4 soldiers, 2 men and 2 women, awaited him, dressed in smart Navy uniforms and armed with Gauss rifles and pistols. One of the men had a lieutenant's insignia on his shoulder, and he came forward.
"Captain Duggan," he said, offering a smile. "I'm Lieutenant Mitchinson. I've been told to bring you up to the Maximilian."
Duggan studied the man. He was average height, with reddish hair and lines at the corners of his eyes, which suggested he'd been in the Corps for decades.
"Well met, Lieutenant. Let's get on our way." "After you, sir."
Duggan walked confidently towards the shuttle steps. He'd once been tricked into boarding a shuttle by his enemies, but additional security put in place since the incident made him confident there'd be no repeat. His boots produced a faint reverberation on the metal as he climbed and he entered the passenger bay. There was seating for 20. These weren't the type of seats he was used to seeing on the Space Corps' usual shabby transports. These seats were clean, new, and made for comfort. 4 more soldiers were inside, looking watchful and impressing Duggan with their professionalism. They greeted him courteously, and he took a seat, finding it as comfortable as it appeared. Lieutenant Mitchinson cast a watchful eye over the bay to ensure everything was in order, then made his way towards the cockpit. He stopped himself on the threshold.
"Captain Duggan, would you like to sit in?"
It was a nice gesture, and Duggan accepted the offer. As it happened, he was curious to know what the cockpit was like on this new generation shuttle. He stepped into the cool-lit room, where he was immediately struck by the similarities and the differences. The function was the same, while the form was new. He didn't like to be cynical, but this shuttle was the same as every other one, just dressed in a smarter suit. There were 2 black leather bucket seats in front of the curved console, and Duggan took the second. Lieutenant Mitchinson didn't mess around.
"We've got clearance."
There was a single mechanical switch on the console, which he flicked upwards. Then he accepted a set of pre-programmed coordinates on the main screen.
"Off we go."
The shuttle lifted off as easily as that. A counter sped through an ever-increasing series of numbers, which changed quickly enough to suggest the shuttle was at full permitted thrust.
"I don't recall hearing about the Maximilian's arrival," said Duggan.
"No, sir. The Tilser Command was made aware. Other than that, nobody."
Duggan didn't question it further. It wasn't unusual for a fleet warship to travel in comparative secrecy. Gossip spread fast, and it wasn't in the Space Corps' interest for the movements of its spacecraft to be plastered across the top of every news source. Speculation was rife enough without adding to it. The trip was longer than expected, taking over an hour.
"They're sitting a good distance off-world," Duggan remarked. "The Maximilian is behind Overtide's moon, sir. We're having to make a half-circuit to get there."
Eventually, they came close enough to the ES Maximilian to bring it up on the shuttle sensors. The Maximilian, along with the Devastator, were the only 2 Hadron supercruisers left in the Navy. Their hulls were old, but the design was years ahead of its time. It would have been easy for the Space Corps to mothball or dismantle these vessels. Instead, they chose to continuously modify them in order to keep them relevant. There were several more under construction, though not due to enter service for a year or more. The war with the Ghasts was over, but there was an ongoing requirement for something which could match the latest Oblivion battleships.
"It's a mean-looking bastard," said Mitchinson as he looked over the image of the Maximilian.
The supercruiser could have been a scaled-up version of the now-destroyed ESS Crimson. It bristled with weaponry and countermeasures. Duggan counted 4 particle beams and 12 shatterer tubes.
There were numerous splinter batteries, visible as rectangular-shaped housings which protruded from the hull in dozens of places. He didn't know how many Lambda missile clusters there were. The number started to become meaningless when they got so high. It's a wonder it's ever out of the shipyard, given the number of...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?